that one in the back of my head. I found a 2.5 watt light bulb. By the way, I started up with a higher wattage, check. And I worked my way down to, I figured that would work because it was only 1.5 volts on the meter. But I did start up with higher voltage rating light bulbs and worked my way down. So I just want to comment too, if anybody's interested in what we're talking about as far as 60 cycle hums, if you go onto the net, I made it a small URL you could listen to either 60 or 50 cycle hums, by the way, you can hear what it sounds like. It's a real good duplication of what I heard, and somebody, I don't know if they've never really heard it and wants to concentrate a little bit to see what it sounds like, what we're talking about, as the exact duplication of what I was hearing, which is 60 cycles. Without the, you know, I use the oscilloscope too, but you can go to this website and drop it. It's a short website. It's http://. tinyurl, that's tinyurl.com/, don't forget to put that slash in, I'll give this to you phonetically, Yankee, Charlie, Bravo, Delta, Sierra, Foxtrot, Echo. So it's http://tinyurl.com/YCBDSFE. You could either click on the, you know, play the 60 cycle hum, what it sounds like, or a 50 cycle hum, if you're interested in that. Back to you, Dick. WS2N.
Comment into YJC. Go ahead, Lou. Paul, before when I asked you what the voltage was, you never did measure the voltage when both grounds were open. I'm wondering if that was 110 volts, and you're syncing to the 2.5 amps at your house. Boy, that that's a real issue, and I can't believe that supervisor sort of blew it off and said that's normal. But you could have also taken advantage of that and used that to charge up batteries and get some free power. Hi. Back to net N2YJC.
Okay, comment, Lou, on the voltages. Yeah, Lou, I said 1.8 volts, and 0.47 in the house. Amperage outside was 2 amps. There's no way I could check the voltages. In fact, I did not check the amperage out there. The LIPA did. He put his meter on there. I saw it. He showed that to me. He couldn't check the, you know, he's not going to touch Cablevision's work. In other words, you'd have to break that connection and throw a meter across. Is that what you're asking? In other words, maybe I have like 100 volts running down there or something? Is that what you're asking, Lou?
Yeah, I think that's what he was asking. And the technician from Cablevision, who you didn't look over his shoulder, when he opened that up, he saw what the voltage is, but there was no other time that you had the opportunity to open up that not-so-perfect ground lead that got replaced outside the house. That's where Lou is asking what that voltage is. To my knowledge, you did not make that measurement, and Lou is speculating it could have been as high as 110. Now back to you, Paul.
Oh, yeah, that's a possibility. I don't know. I guess they have a bad ground in that box somewhere, and you know, maybe 108 volts are going down that ground, and 2 volts are getting loose and coming into my house or something. Hopefully that's the case. I hope that ground is not completely non-existent out there, and I'm getting everything down. Oh, that would be a horror. And they just put a little fine on their wire, on their grounding wire, and it was there before this all ever happened. You know, the original guy put it there, and they say do not disconnect this. If this thing needs to be disconnected, you know, let's say you're going to put siding on a house, or you're going to pull hose bibs off, or whatever you're going to do. There's a sign that lets you know to have them contact Cablevision and have them do it, just so. So this way nobody goes out and starts pulling their grounds off and checking voltages and amperages. I don't want anybody to get zapped because of this conversation. Back to you, Dick. WS2N.
KC2MDP.
Go ahead, Steve.
K Yeah, just a quick comment. Normal operation, should you see 60-cycle hum on Cablevision's wire? What I'm thinking is they have some sort of leakage. It's possible that, you know, like we were talking about last week, that there's a loose ground and basically, you know, let's say the house next door could have, you know, a loose neutral or something, and it could be leaking back on Cablevision. I ran across this once where they actually, that metal wire they run, you know, that goes to the ground block was actually carrying 120 volts through it, and Cablevision came, cut the wire, and created all kinds of fiascos in the people's house. Back to you.
Comment.
Yeah, Steve, Wesley recognized, but Steve, give us a couple more words about that. You're saying if somebody cut that grounding lead, you saw all kinds of difficulty. How did that difficulty show up? How did the situation finally get resolved? Go ahead, Steve.
Okay, basically it was an old system, you know, with the ground rod, the water clamp was basically non-existent. What happened is they lost the neutral at the house, being that Cablevision grounded their cable wire to, you know, the meter pan of the house that was acting as the neutral. Their cable wire was acting as the neutral for that house, and when the guy came to work on it, he clipped the cable. And basically, they lost the neutral, and, you know, some of the electronics in the house got fried. Back to you.
The so-called dim bright problem. Yeah. If you lose the neutral wire, the so-called unshielded aluminum wire, the third wire, so to speak, that comes into your house, and if that's not making good contact from the voltage-dropping transformer, usually a pole peak transformer, but sometimes below ground, if that's not making good ground, good connection to everything from your power meter outside your house to your fuse panel and all the wiring in the house, then any unequal loading between your red wire and ground and your black wire and ground, if you're not running the exact same amount of wattage on each half of your house, you get the so-called dim-bright problem, where maybe one appliance is going to see 180 volts and the other one's going to see 40. That's not good. And so that's something you've got to worry about. I ran into that problem. In my case, it didn't become completely disconnected, but it developed a extra number of ohms. And I was running into a dim bright problem. I reported it to Long Island Lighting Company way back in those days, and they came and reestablished that ground. In my case, the compression fitting at the post where the line drop comes into the house, that compression fitting had developed a high resistance contact. And the rest of my house, the wiring was apparently okay, and they had to restore that particular connector. And by way of a test, they pinned that one down pretty fast. Wesley, N2XJN, K2RIW, wait for the beep, and give us a little bit less audio, Wesley. Go ahead.
Is my audio okay now?
Still very slightly high, but getting closer.
Okay. Tell me if it's improving or it's not. I'm going to turn the microphone this way. Okay, fine. When we do not know have the sufficient information about what is causing the problem, I believe the concentration on the fact how to solve the problem is the most important factor, because we can talk hours and hours about it. And the simple solution for that is very easy. You go to Home Depot, you buy 8-foot copper rod. You put in your basement next to your electric box. You just use the hammer and put it inside, all the way down. You make sure that this rod is around 12 feet from the ground. And then you put the clip with the wire And the best one is the thick electric wire, the same one that is being used as the phase wire. And you connect that to the rod, and then you connect it to the electrical box. You do not need electrician for that. Electricity is simple, like ABC. Nothing very difficult in it. But the electrician is for the fact that it might be dangerous for the person who does not know what he's doing to do it. If we're talking about the ground, just connecting to the ground does not create any danger to yourself. But I would be also recommending you to put the gloves on you, because if you really have no ground, it might be the potential between your electric box and your ground. Back to you, Decantor Jim.
Yeah, the grounding rod that you've expressed, that you described, the 8-foot long, 5-inch diameter grounding rod, which is either made out of copper clad or galvanized steel, but 5-8 diameter, 8 feet long, that is a so-called EIA standard grounding rod. That if you go to a good electrical supply house, you can buy that. And where you put it is a factor. If you mount it in the right place outside of your house, I think you can get a rather good ground. If you drilled a very small hole in the basement of your house and put it through that hole, where in many cases the soil underneath your basement might be a kind of very fine sand, and depending on the soil quality where you live, that might not make a very good contact to earth. There are ways you can test that. You can measure the quality of the ground, but I would not recommend putting the ground inside the house, the grounding rod. I would put the grounding rod outside the house. And I think the recommendation also is to sink the top of the grounding rod below grade. You actually put it, you take a small hole, so to speak, put it below grade, connect the approximately 6-gauge piece of wire with the right kind of clamp between that grounding rod and the rest of the electrical equipment of your house, and also putting that below grade so that people don't trip over it is a strong recommendation. Now, if you did that to back up the grounding of your system, which is also in many cases using the copper water pipe, if you do a good study, I think you'll find that the copper water pipe of older homes is by far the much better ground than the grounding rod, because it goes, it's a large diameter piece of copper, and it goes lots and lots of feet below grade and makes very good contact. Unfortunately, many modern day houses have a plastic pipe for the water in the house as opposed to the old fashioned copper pipe, and therefore establishing that kind of a ground becomes more difficult. So these are some of my thoughts on the subject. Maybe other people have got other comments. Give me a call, let us right now. K2RIW in the TechNet.
KC2MDP.
And 2YJC.
Okay, two related questions and 2EL.
Steve, Lou, and Rich in that order. Steve first, MDP, go ahead.
Okay, thank you, Dick. Yeah, a ground rod will definitely help. It's not the cure-all, that's for sure, like you were saying. It all depends on the soil. We had a grounding problem at a particular house one time. Just to get them going, we sunk 2 ground rods 8 feet apart, and it still didn't work. We ended up physically grounding to the water pipe just to establish a ground again. So ground rod is certainly not the cure-all. It'll help. It's more for lightning protection, I do believe, than anything else. Back to you.
Very fine, Steve, and I believe you do work in the electrical industry. Lou, into YJC, go right ahead.
Yeah, Dick, I'm portable now. Am I making it okay?
You're rather good. Go right ahead.
Okay. The ground rod in the basement works excellent if your water table is near the bottom of your basement, so to speak. My water table is 4 feet below my basement, and I put my shack ground right under my desk. And boy, that's a great ground.
KC2, QIQ with a comment.
Okay, Rich and Glenn in that order. N2EO, what are you using for grounding, Rich? Those guys in Whitestone know how to do it. You got it, Rich.
Okay, thank you. It's a related question. You may want to pick somebody else up, but I'll just paraphrase it. I had a 30-amp 220 line brought in just the other day. Electrician was here on Friday, and he used a 4-watt, a four-pin twist lock 30-amp plug. I'm wondering why a 4-pin. I said to the fellow who was doing the worker, I said, he tried to tell me, which made no sense to me. He said on a 220 system, and I quote, neutral is hot, which makes no sense to me. I think we weren't communicating. Yeah, Dick.
I am guessing that when it comes to a 220 circuit at 30 ampere or above, to be code, to be up to the code, I think it might have to be a four-prong twist lock. You don't have a plug that looks anything like the plug you've got in a 110-volt circuit, the three-prong plug. I don't think there is a 220, 30-ampere version of that. That's my guess. I think he should have given you that as an answer to be up to code. But we'll find out more as we talk to the people on frequency. You've got a lot more smarts in that area. Glenn, KC2QIQ, you got it.
Sunny Beach is ZEX, also with a comment.
ZEX recognized, but Glenn first. Go ahead, Glenn.
Hi, Dick. This was just for a matter of safety. I heard a few discussions about putting ground rods inside or below the foundation of the house or somewhere within the confines of the living area of the house. And I just wanted to let everybody know this is a very, very bad idea for a lot of safety reasons. Most of your ground rods should be located on the outside of the house and preferably at least 12 inches from the foundation. And the reasoning behind this is because of lightning strikes. If your house ever gets struck by lightning, you want the shortest path on the outside of the house going into good ground. If you've got one, if you've got a good solid ground, like you've got good moist water, you know, with a very, very high water table underneath your house, and you've got a very, very good solid ground going into the ground underneath the center of your house, and your ham equipment and other things are all attached to this ground, well, guess what? When if lightning does strike your house and gets onto your electrical system, guess the path it's going to take? Right through the middle of your house. By all means, if you have this type of ground rod, get one on the outside of the house, at least 12 inches from the outside of the foundation from the house. You don't want the lightning going through the living area of your house. Always on the outside. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
Beautiful answer.
I have a question about that, N2YJC. Lou recognized, but Gerald's going to be next. W2ZEX, go ahead, Gerald.
I grabbed the wrong microphone. Okay, this is WB2ZX. I just had my electricity redone, actually it was done in October, 200 amp service in my house. They ended up putting, since the electrical panel was in the garage and the outside of the house, because there were three steps, is actually like a foot and a half higher than the garage, they actually put the ground rod in the garage. They basically drilled a hole through the cement and, you know, just basically pushed it in so the hole went down 7 feet. But they also ran a wire back to the water pipe. Since it's copper wire, they ran like a number 4 or number 6 gauge, I think it's pretty thick, to the water pipe, and they put a connection on the other side of the water meter. So actually the main ground goes below the water meter, but they put a jumper across the water meter in case there's a cold water pipe ground in the house. Con Ed came the other day, they wanted to inspect the job. All the guy wanted to see was the fact that there was a ground to the water pipe. They didn't care about a ground rod or anything else. At 30 seconds, he took a look at the cone where it goes. He said, fine, and that was it. K2RIW, WB2ZEX.
Interesting. I'm a little bit amazed that the Con Ed person wasn't as lightning savvy as Lou is mentioning. I mean, as Glenn is mentioning. Lou, N2YJC, go right ahead.
Yeah, okay. Glenn was commenting, I believe, on my comment about the ground in the shack. Well, first let me say I have the normal power company ground on the far end of the house where the service comes in. And I have three major masts. I don't have any towers because I'm not allowed, but I have three masts on the roof. And at the bottom of each mast, there's a 2-aught ground cable or ground wire going from each mast to ground 8-foot ground rods, very much the way you described, Glenn, about 12 inches away from the house. In the flower beds that the masts are all grounded to, and most of the antennas are shunt fed except for the dipoles. So I think I'm pretty good for lightning on there. The ground in the shack, I elected to put the ground rod basically right under my desk because I figured that would be better for my counterpoise, for my 160 meter end fed. How can I put this? Instead of running the ground wire from the shack out to the side of the house to a ground rod, I figure the shorter path directly below the desk would be better. Of course, that's not the only ground. You know, there are several grounds all around the house, basically at the bottom of each mast. I wonder if you can comment on that, Glenn, and to YJC.
Actually, I'm outside. Am I making the repeater?
Tiny bit noisy, but quite good. Go right ahead, Glenn.
Okay, actually, as far as ground rods go inside the station, my feeling is like this. If you tie all of your equipment together on with a piece of pipe inside your house locally around your transceiver, so that you, let's say, use like a copper water pipe, half inch in diameter, and you were to run it back of your station and tie everything to that on a pretty nice local ground, you really don't have to put that right to earth ground, right in that spot. I would always try to earth ground to the outside. Yes, it's good that you have the main coupling on the outside of the house from the other areas, but there again, you never know the path that lightning will run. It will run in one direction, sometimes it will run. You're just always, you know, from my own standpoint, and a safety issue, I would never want to have a ground rod inside that's going to run through the living area of the house. I'd rather have that thing floating and maybe only connected to the utility ground, which is supplied by the power company, and goes to the ground rod outside the house. But you can certainly tie everything together on the local ground, but I just wouldn't put it through the earth, because generally, when lightning does strike, it's going to go to earth. And you just don't want any of those paths inside the living area of the house. You prefer to have them on the outside of the house. And there again, that's not to say that, you know, like in the other case with the other gentleman who had in a garage may be considered in certain local districts as not the living area of the house, so it's acceptable. But here again, if it's certainly definitely like a basement or an area where people live, and you could have lightning running through a wall in the house and going to somewhere in the center of the structure, I would, you know, seriously think about disconnecting that ground and moving it to the outside of the house. KC2QIQ.
One more, Dick.
Go ahead, Lou.
Oh, Glenn, I got to disagree. I completely understand what you're saying if that was my only station ground, or if that ground was grounding my antenna masts, which are mounted to the house. But if I do what you're suggesting, for example, I have two HF radios, an HF amp, an antenna tuner, various 2-meter radios, most of which are tied to this bonding bar under my desk, and then I have a ground strap going to this ground rod below my desk. If I was to relocate that ground rod outside the house, that's another path. If lightning did get in the shack, then it would have to go through my wall, the wall of the house, just above the foundation, to reach ground. formed outside the house, and I figured if lightning did enter the shack through one of the coaxes, one of the many coaxes that come from the roof down to the shack, I want to get that to ground right away. I'd rather not have that pass through the wall one more time. Of course, again, all of the masts are grounded, and most of the antennas are shunt-fed, so the antennas are grounded. I got to disagree on that one point, Glenn Gadd.
I'm going to guess that the bottom line of all that we're hearing is that there is no perfect grounding system. In general, the more, the merrier. You really want to talk about a tough grounding system, you should talk to W1MVA. Mike Victor, is it Mike? All of a sudden my mind's going blank on the guy who runs the microwave reflector. W1MVA, I think it is. Whiskey Alpha 1, Mike Bravo Alpha. He has a really tough grounding system where he lives in a section of Massachusetts where he carefully chose literally a mountaintop because he's a serious VHF, UHF, SHF operator. He wanted to be above the terrain. That's the good news. The bad news is he lives on top of this mountain, which is essentially a chunk of granite, and the word ground for him is an extremely relative word. His grounding system consists of a whole lot of rods going through the granite. I think there's something like 15 or 20 rods all interconnected with a grid of copper braid, and that's all surrounding his house. And I think he only has something like a 60-foot crank-up tower. And he gets struck with lightning a couple of times per year and has suffered quite a bit of damage because of it. And sometimes, no matter how much grounding you have, a huge grid of grounding rods, it might not be enough. The word ground, let me drop, is kind of relative when it comes to VHF, UHF, and SHF frequencies. You probably heard the funny story about the antenna department in one of the companies I used to work at, where an official who only had partial electronic knowledge, a person who was in charge of supervision, would occasionally come into the antenna testing laboratory and complain about the fact that the antenna being tested, it might be a tiny little printed circuit antenna, you know, something as big as your hand, that it wasn't being properly grounded. To which the technician would say, hey, there's a great big hunking piece of coax cable going to it, going to all of our equipment, which in turn is grounded to the building. And he said, no, that's not enough. It's got to have a separate ground. These were back in the days when we were becoming very sensitive about electrostatic discharge. And in order to make him happy, they thought they were creating a joke. They picked up one of these red ceramic flower pots, which was probably about 8 inches in diameter and about 10 inches tall, and they filled it up with some soil, and they ran a piece of 6-gauge wire from that flower pot sitting in front of the antenna being tested, and they ran that 6-gauge wire up to the antenna under test, and across the front of the flower pot they wrote the words on a piece of paper, good earth ground. And whenever that official came through, they would point to that, and he went away happy. Obviously, the flower pot was connected to nothing. But they called it a ground, and had the sign on it that said, good earth ground, and a heavy piece of wire coming from it. So the word ground is very relative. When it comes to studying what lightning does, and there are quite a few articles you can read, and I can't think of the name of the company in Nevada that makes lightning arrestor devices. It'll eventually come to me. They print a beautiful $20 book that you can order from them describing what we now know about lightning. And there's also a lot more to be learned about lightning. And in certain difficult applications, like in Tom Williams' case, WA1MBA, on top of that mountain in Massachusetts, no matter what he uses for ground, it's not enough. The more the merrier. So there's no perfect solution. It's relative. And it's relative to what frequency you're operating at, how bad is the lightning strike, where did it come from, is it a positive or a negative lightning strike. You can have the world's best grounding and the world's best bypassing devices, surge arrestors and whatever, in your house. It will all give you a lot of protection. Let me drop. Mother Nature decides to give you one of those positive polarity lightning bolts of 150,000 amperes for 20 microseconds, and quite often there's not one single strike in there, there's about six or seven of them in a very rapid series. If any of the equipment you own is subjected to one of those, and a buddy of mine was, and in his particular case, it struck a small changing shed that he had out by his pool. The lightning bolt decided to strike that, and it struck all of the wiring that went to his pool. And then that wiring came back to the house through the fuse panel. And all of that earth with that conduit got blasted. And there was a trench formed from where the lightning bolt first struck. It damaged the pool pump and some of the equipment connected to the pool, and opened up this trench all the way back to the house. It didn't go all the way to the house, but it came very close. One of those really positive lightning bolts. Created no damage in the house. Created a lot of damage to his pool equipment. He's awful thankful that that one didn't strike the house. You get one of those striking anything you own, and it's going to be damaged, no matter how much protection you've got. So all the protection you put in is relative. It'll help you a lot 90-some-odd percent of the time. There is no perfect protection from lightning. It is an extremely high power experiment in high energy physics. And it can do a lot of damage no matter what you got. So if you built a perfect Faraday shield over your house, a highly conductive Quonset hut, yes, you would be protected. But I don't think any of us want to live that way. We don't think we need it, although Tom Williams almost needs that. Anyway, any further questions or comments on the subject, give me a call with us right now. K2RAW in the TechNet.
KC2, QAQ.
Glenn recognized. Anyone else?
K2KEY.
Mel recognized. Anyone else? Okay, Glenn, you got it. And after that, Mel, who lives right at the seashore, guarantee he's seen some lightning that has made him say, my blank. Over to you, Glenn.
Dick, what you're saying there's an awful lot of truth to, but there is some certain exceptions. I think that, you know, being ham radio operators and people working with a lot of electronic equipment and things that are hanging up in the air like antennas, there's certain considerations that you have to take into. Grounding rods are most effective where basic lines are coming into the house, where the electric power enters the house, right where the power line before it enters into the house is the best place to terminate a nice 10-foot grounding rod right there. If you have a pool in the backyard that has electric service running out to it, right near the pool pump, there's usually a nice ground somewhere right on the pool pump that you can attach to. Sink a nice 10-foot ground rod right there at the pool. If you have antennas coming down off the roof on the top, where you can get an antenna wire to run along the outside of the house, down somewhere around 12 inches off the foundation, put the ground rod right there. If you've got coaxial cables coming into your house, put some kind of bulkhead between the outside of the house to the inside of the house, attach a firm ground there, run it straight down into the ground on the outside of the house. There really shouldn't be, and that's basically only on the entry points for any kind of conductors coming into the house, cable lines, anything like that, telephone lines, any kind of copper lines coming into the house should have a termination into a nice solid ground point right on the outside of the house. The thing I was trying to get across before is that as long as those lines from the outside of the house are terminated into ground rods, in most cases, the lightning energy is going to follow the shortest path to that local ground. There's no other conductors coming into the house because you've covered them all. If you have an additional one inside the house, now you're creating a secondary loop. So now, if something did sneak through and is looking for another path, it could find the path underneath the house. But as long as all the paths look greatest on the outside of the house, it'll follow that path. And furthermore, as far as RF grounding is concerned, as long as your feed lines are balanced and your station is set up properly, you shouldn't have to attach to earth. Basically, you ground all your equipment together, but there's no real requirement from your inside shack to actually have to go down to earth ground. All that can definitely be done outside the house. And with your antenna tuners and tuning your VSWR on your cables, there really shouldn't be any reason for a ground to be inside the shack. K2RIW, KC2, QIQ.
For the most part, I'm going to agree with that. there are a ridiculous number of ham radio operators who have been led to believe that if you have television interference, all you've got to do is establish a better ground on your transmitting equipment, and the problem will be solved. Absolutely not true most of the time. The word RF ground is a peculiar set of words. Almost, it's a nice theoretical concept, but it almost doesn't exist. If you got the right kind of a balancing device at your antenna, and the right setup of the transmission line going to it, that's essentially all the grounding is required for proper RF performance. We put grounding in our equipment primarily for human safety, secondarily for lightning protection, and sometimes we do it for RF performance improvement. In the case of an NFED ZEP antenna, yes, maybe better local grounding will help. But other than that, the antenna itself should be properly balanced and bound, B-A-L-U-N-E-D, the right kind of a balancing device connected to the antenna, and that is better than grounding. Just simply putting a ground on the transmitter, most of the time, in my opinion, is not going to solve television interference, for instance. But that's a bunch of opinions. I'll bet you've seen some beautiful lightning bolts come across that body of water that's close to Manhattan Beach where you live, Mel. I'll bet your neighbors and you from time to time have had some fantastic lightning strikes, and I'll bet the majority of the lightning strikes are not the lightning directly hitting your antennas. A much, much larger target is the Con Ed power wiring, which is a great big grid going across your whole community. Lightning, when it strikes that and gets conducted into your house by your wiring, I'll bet you that's where 90-some-odd% of the damage takes place. That's a bunch of opinions. K2KEY, K2RIW.
K2 again.
Eric recognized, but Mel first. Go ahead, Mel.
Okay, this is K2KEY. Yeah, well, I've had lightning problems there. Galore. The tower here has been struck a number of times. I think at least three times. And in fact, when it was struck one time, it sounded like the thing was a big bell. It rang so hard, I thought for sure it's going to come down, whatever. But I'm going to agree with Glenn. Exactly. People think that a lot of times the ground rod is the counterpoint for an antenna. It's not a radio. It's not the same thing as radio. And I hate when they tell me it's a RF ground. It isn't. Not for an RF ground. And I've said this over and over again. And they look at me cross-eyed. I said, it's a DC ground. However, what I've got in my shack, I've got a contactor. When I flip the switches open in the shack, it breaks the 220 line. And the whole system has actually become disconnected. In other words, there is no connection to a neutral or anything in my shack as of now, once the contactor is open. And once the contactor is open, the lines that normally go supply the power to the equipment, that side, in other words, the what you would call the lower side, is now grounded, all twisted. It actually goes together into the ground block, the 110, the 220 lines are just open then. Now, with the ground rod I have down here, I have a whole grounding system outside here. There's 8 rods down here, in the yard, along the side, all in the grass area, and they're all frayed together. Let me let it drop and say a few more words about this. Found that a lot of these ground rods, when you put them on with a clamp, after a period of time outside, being exposed to the conditions outside, the ground has got a problem. And they tested it. One guy did a nice test on it, where he put a very high current after a ground rod was outside for a while, between, in other words, he just put between the clamp and the body of the ground rod, put a high current, and it got hot. The clamp got hot because the clamp was not making good contact to the ground rod anymore. So what I have, I have number 4 wire connected the whole system together, and I braised it. It's all braised. copper line is brazed right onto the ground rod to the next ground rod. Everything is brazed together, and including I have a well here, a well that goes down 36 feet. That's also grounded to the system, which is also everything is brazed together. Nothing is clamped anywhere, Dick. I don't trust clamping outside, to tell you the truth, after a number of, maybe a couple of years, over.
Interesting, because the EIE standard for towers, RS-222, I think it's Echo or Foxtrot these days, does talk about clamps. I don't think they insist on welding, but maybe they do. In the case of your broadcast tower, Eric, I bet you've been struck with lightning a few times. I know from each one of the legs of that tower. I'll bet you there's a substantial grounding system. And so give us some words along these lines. KE2EJ, K2RIW on the TechNet.
KC2QIQ with a comment about clamps.
Glenn recognized, but Eric first. Go ahead, Eric.
I think grounding is a very important issue. If you remember the World Trade Center, usually every lightning storm will bring several hits to that tower. And it happens quite regularly. Or it happened quite regularly. It also happens at the Empire State Building. So if you want to keep your transmitter on the air, grounding's really important. But now to Plainview, where I have my own ground system into the, it's connected to the tower, it's connected to the transmitter. Actually, the kind of bonding that we use is six stainless steel bolts and flat pieces of copper. Although there's a strapping where the ground rods go into the ground, and there's eight of them. And it does a really good job of protecting the transmitter because the antennas themselves, which is really at the top of the tower, is at DC ground. So the lightning actually hits the antenna and goes straight into the ground, and there's a little leakage that runs back into the transmitter, but because of the cavities that are there, and we actually go waveguide, well, we did go waveguide with the UHF, so it was a minimal problem. But actually, the EMP pulse that's made occasionally will blow out some FETs and other equipment, even in the other building, because the amount of energy that that lightning bolt burns is absolutely incredible. Although up at the World Trade Center, I've actually had a 3 dB coupler that the output melts, and that was on VHF. That doesn't happen too often, but with proper grounding, which is essential, keeping things alive. So they put a lot of effort into grounding. Usually it's 4-inch copper bar or 6-inch wide copper bar, and they don't braze it, they bolt it together, so that way you can make any length or appropriate connections that you need to in your particular installation. So the fact that the antennas are at DC ground is befuddling to a lot of people, is that the antenna is still resonant, but it's at ground, so there you go. K2IW, K2J.
And that's the magic of microwaves, or at least the UHF waves, where a FET device gets sometimes fried. I wonder if you've considered making some of the interconnections, particularly when it comes to digital commands, making those by way of fiber optics. Over to you, Eric.
Now, interestingly enough, in the other building, the things that blow up are like the intercom matrix. I use these bifed amplifiers. And you have cables that run the length of the building, so it acts as a good antenna. And, you know, the induced voltage there just kind of fries things. Not the kind of thing that you could isolate with fiber optics, so to speak. It would make it way too expensive anyway. But, you know, you have intercom stations all over the place. It's like your alarm systems. I mean, I've had alarm systems fry from the EMP pulse of lightning hits, so. You know, there's some things that are just wires. Interestingly enough, on the lines that have shielded cables don't get whacked, and the lines that are just twisted pairs get whacked, so there you go.
So I think you're saying the Cat5 cables are very vulnerable, but something that's got shielded wiring, like HDMI, would be surviving?
Well, all HDMI devices, if you look at the specs on the receivers and the transmitters, they're capable of a 10,000 volt surge, so they say.
Yeah, I've been recently studying HDMI cable. I was amazed that it's got four twisted pair signal paths that are themselves inside of a shield and a separate wire to that shield, and each of the four shields are insulated from each other, all inside the cable, with a few extra other wires for 5 volts and ground and recognition and whatever, and then an overall shield around that whole assembly. So when it comes to the actual signal pair, my goodness, is that thing protected, at least it appears to be. Glenn, KC2QIQ, go right ahead, wait for the beep.
Yeah, very good, Dick. Just a quick comment about clamps and, you know, and grounding. If you go into a Home Depot or into an electrical supply house, you'll see that there's all different types of clamps that you can buy for, you know, electrical grounding. And, you know, the most common one a lot of people find when they're putting up a tower or they're putting up a tripod is this clamp that I call the three-screw clamp. It's got two screws on the outside and the little one in the middle that you basically put the ground wire in and you tighten it down. This is good for attaching to a tripod or to a leg of a tower, and they make very, very good connections, and they last for years. You know, you clean up the surface area, make sure there's no paint in the way and other things like that, and they ground pretty well. But these are definitely not to be used for what I call direct burial grounds, the ones where you hammer the ground rod into the ground, and then you put it underneath earth. Generally, these things will open up into high resistance and probably less than a year. They're really not, definitely not made for direct burial. They do make a direct burial clamp, and what this clamp looks like is it looks like basically a machined out piece of brass, and it's got a screw on the other side that's usually like a 7/16 bolt. And basically what you do is you slide this brass piece over the top of the ground rod, and then you take your 6-gauge wire or larger and basically slide it in with the grounding rod. And then you take a wrench and you tighten down on the 7/16 inch bolt, and you tighten it down until it basically squeezes the ground wire right against the ground rod. These type of clamps can be directly buried in under soil, and they'll last for 30 years plus. KC2QIQ.
So that V-shaped clamping device that you've just described, there's really only one bolt to be tightened, the 5/16 bolt that you mentioned. And because the 6-gauge or whatever wire is in direct contact with the grounding rod, there is essentially no other interface except for the clamping device, which is also on the outside of both. That sounds like the right way to go, particularly if you buy one of those that are made with high quality. It's a hardened copper-like device. Is that true, Glenn? And that bolt that you're tightening is going through a threaded hole. Is that true? Over you, Glenn. K2LIW.
KC2MDP.
Okay, you do that.
Steve and Eric in that order, but Glenn first. Go ahead, Glenn.
Yes, it is. And you can see definitely the name of that clamp is called the direct burial clamp. That's what it's actually called. And in almost all electrical, you know, where you're going to basically do the outside, you know, burying of a ground rod, that is the one that you're supposed to use. That it's basically like the hollowed out piece of brass or copper with a threaded and usually a stainless steel bolt, that and it's usually like a 7/16. And you can usually, you know, get these almost in any Home Depot or electrical supply house. Back to you, to K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
Glad you brought that to my attention. You got it, Steve. Wait for the beep.
Okay, Dick. Yeah, that three-piece clamp you talked to, the one with the three screws in it, that's a water pipe ground clamp. That's basically designed, you know, to be water ground in inside your house. The other one he's alluding to, the one piece, they call it an egg corn. That's the one you're actually supposed to use on the ground clamp, on the ground rod, I should say. They also make stuff that's called Scotch Coat. It's made by 3M, comes in a red and white can. It's this real black sticky stuff that looks like a real heavy-duty rubber cement. If you want to ensure a really good ground, you put your red corn on, you wire your ground clamp, and then you paint this stuff on there, and that stuff will last for 50 years or better. Back to you.
I guess I didn't know that Scotch Coat came as a black, rubbery substance. And I guess what you would do is you would dig a small hole, pound the ground rod into the ground below grade, properly attach the acorn connector and your ground wire, spray it with Scotch Coat, the black rubbery stuff, let it dry, then pile the dirt back onto that below grade connector. I think that's the procedure you're describing. Is that true, Steve? Go ahead.
Yeah, pretty much, Dick. Now, this stuff comes in a can. It just comes with a can with a little brush, and, you know, basically you dip the brush into the can and paint the surface you want to cover with this Scotch Coat stuff. Back to you.
Interesting. Didn't know it came in a can. I thought Scotch Coat was always a spray. Shows you what I know. Eric, K2EJ? I don't have to tell you to wait for the beep.
Yeah, we use Scotch Coat. I keep a gallon can of it handy. I use it for a lot of stuff. It's good stuff. One thing that some people tend to ignore, and that is when they're putting stuff together, they use dissimilar metal. If you're working with a copper rod, your clamps and your screws and everything really ought to be copper. Otherwise, you get all sorts of oxidation forces happening when you don't have the same number of electrons in the outer ring of the atom. I've seen a lot of failures from people mixing and mashing metals, and over the years, it makes for, like, no connection. Dick?
Yeah, if you go to the right website, and there's many of them, and you look at electromotive series, and they'll describe a long list of conductors. And in theory, you should be using conductors that are very closely spaced on that list. And if you don't, that electromotive series, the galvanic action, the battery-like action you get between two dissimilar metals that are separated by many individual entries on that list, you make that mistake, and you're going to get corrosion. I first ran into this where I built my first 6-meter Yagi out of aluminum conduit tubing, and where the gamma rod was being constructed on the driven element, it seemed very convenient to me to take a copper strapping, wrap it around the aluminum conduit of the driven element, and connect it to the rest of the gamma rod. Well, within about 6 months to a year, some green corrosion existed between the copper strap and the aluminum elements, and they were making really flaky contact and creating an awful lot of grief. Each time I transmitted on 6 meters, I was getting a different standing wave ratio, and the receiving characteristics were really spooky until I realized what was going on. The solution in my case was amazingly simple. Let me drop. By looking at that galvanic series, I discovered that copper and solder are reasonably compatible. Solder and aluminum are reasonably compatible. Not perfect, but good enough. So all I did was to take that copper strapping, clean it up with Scotch-Brite, tin it with solder, and the tin surface was then brought back in contact with the aluminum rod. Not perfect, but it worked for the next 4 years with no trouble. So in my case, it was a fairly simple solution. A better solution would be to make the strapping out of stainless steel. Alrighty. I know that we've got a guy named Steve who signed in, and maybe by now we've put him to sleep. Steve, K2IGHICH, something like that. My handwriting is too darn IGV. Too sloppy on this one. Steve, if you're still there, go right ahead with your question or comment. K2RIW in the TechNet. Okay, I think we put Steve to sleep, and I don't blame him. And Wesley, you're the next up at bat. N2XJN, go right ahead with your question or comment. K2RIW.
Okay, just let me know, is my audio okay?
Audio is quite good. Please proceed. RF is quite good.
Okay, November to X-ray, Juliet, November. What I was trying to talk about is something that some people believe is the biggest revolution in the history of humanity, which actually leads you to never pay one single penny to any utility company. Once you have energy, you don't even have to use the gas, because then you could use your electric stoves, anything that is driven by electric current, in order to give you that kind of comfortability at home, or maybe in business. There are two things that I would like to talk about it. One of them is over unity, and the second one is perpetual motion. I was thinking about it, and I actually came to the conclusion that perpetual motion cannot exist without over unity factor, because just for the description of perpetual motion is that the body that was once put in motion sustained that motion. Now, if we're talking about the factors like friction or any other factors, the body that was once put in motion has to have more power than just the power to sustain the motion in the empty space where there is no atmosphere, and also different factors when you have enough atmosphere, or any other the factors like magnetic field. Since last 20 years, there was many guys that were trying to reach over unity and perpetual motion, now also as perpetuum mobile. One of them is EBM. For the guys who are listening to me, you go to your YouTube and you put EBM 720. EBM England Bravo Mary 720. You're going to see the generator that is rated for 10 megawatts, weighs 15 tons, and this generator, Hungarian, claim to be able to produce 10 megawatts of power, free energy. I'm back. I'm waiting for the beep.
Can you repeat the search again?
Okay. Now, that it's EBM, Echo Bravo Mary 720. Now, they also state that they license this generator to General Electric in Canada. There is another guy who is known as Ludec Technology of Australia. Ludec Australia Pty Ltd. And they claim to have over unity device. From other people, there is a Russian inventor who presented that device to, I don't have his name in front of me, but there are plenty of them in here. I find out that factors, they are most common in all of the over unity or perpetuum mobile motors are: each device contains capacitor, coil, spark, and magnet. Mostly they use the magnetic motors that where the magnetic attraction and magnetic repulsion provides movement to the motor. The spark is needed with these devices to sustain the motion. and the spark is actually being called spontaneous.